Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of May 7th. This week we're marking the 50th anniversary of the book The Other America by Michael Harrington. The College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts recently held a two-day conference to mark this event, and we have an interview with Tom Landy, who helped organize the event and is the director of the McFarland Center for Religion, Ethics, and Culture at Holy Cross. I recorded a conversation with Tom Landy from his offices in Worcester, Massachusetts, and some of the questions have been re-recorded for purposes of sound quality. After my interview, we feature some remarks delivered by Morris Isserman at the conference at Holy Cross. Professor Isserman is a professor at Hamilton College and the author of The Other American, a biography of Michael Harrington. I began my interview with Tom Landy by asking him to introduce Michael Harrington to a younger generation who may not be familiar with his legacy.
Sure. Michael Harrington is actually a Holy Cross graduate, the class of 47. He's also Jesuit educated from St. Louis High School in St. Louis, Missouri. Really, Harrington is the last great socialist leader in America. He's, his legacy, if you took Eugene Debs, you took Norman Thomas after him, Harrington was one who really led a socialist charge in America when there was one, and it was a real one. It was an American socialism, very different from European socialism. But Harrington was extraordinarily influential in his day. I talk to faculty who still talk about having been at talks when he filled auditoriums. He was a great lecturer and thinker, published dozens of books, and really was someone who helped America pay attention to social problems. He, as I said, he was a graduate of Holy Cross. He had an interesting background. He went from Holy Cross to Yale Law School, stayed there a year, didn't like it, went to University of Chicago, didn't like that for a year, and got involved with Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker, which really helped change his direction and really focused him on poverty in America and got him going and moving to address that. But what he's really known for is, I think, among a generation of people, really having had a profound effect on them, helping them believe in the possibility of overcoming poverty in America.
Holy Cross recently sponsored a conference to mark the 50th anniversary of Michael Harrington's book, The Other America, which he wrote when he was just 34 years old. What specific impact did that book have on the political discussions that were going on at the time?
There's a real debate about the direct influence of it. Some people have argued that it's what caused President Kennedy to begin what became known as the War on Poverty, or Lyndon Johnson, later the Great Society movement. But what clearly was happening beforehand is that Kennedy was becoming much more aware of poverty in America and wanted to do something to solve that. He at least read a long review in the New Yorker magazine about the book and had a copy of it. What's unclear is whether he read the book itself. He had a copy. Did he read it? I'd say that the thing that really helped was that originally there was a kind of piecemeal effort in the administration, a desire to help on housing, on a number of areas. And what the book seems to have done is, A, mobilized a great many Americans to begin to believe that it was possible to solve problems around poverty in America. And it helped them to think of a need for a really holistic solution. It made the administration think that they had to do more than small steps in order to solve something. And he got people to think that that because we were the wealthiest society in the world, in world history, really, that we could really eliminate poverty, which was a bit of a utopian vision, but a really great one. I would say that he mobilized Americans behind the political change. He wasn't so directly involved in it. He was invited to the White House to help do some drafting on some of the legislation. I don't think that he had a very direct role in that, in a very pragmatic sense, in terms of things you could point to in the first legislation that came out. But he made them believe it was possible, and he made them think big. The Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration never really thought big enough in Harrington's terms. He thought they were spending too little money compared to the way that money was spent in the 1930s during the Depression. I mean, one of the interesting things about it as a book is that people will say Harrington helped America discover poverty. And you have to look at that today and say that seems rather odd. How could people have not paid attention to the fact in America that there was poverty? One of the most interesting things, though, is that if you look at a lot of the social and cultural criticism, the books that were really selling in big numbers in America were kind of cultural laments. Americans were concerned after a period of real economic expansion in the 1950s, after the Second World War, there was this fear that we were becoming too affluent, that it was making us too soft. We wouldn't be able to fight the Cold War. You found books about the affluent society from John Kenneth Galbraith, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. There was all this sense that sort of prosperity was going to make us weak. And there was an assumption on the part of policy elites, economists, and others. They used the phrase that a rising tide lifts all boats. So the sense was that as the economy grew, poverty would disappear. Of course it would be taken care of because everyone would be better off. And that certainly wasn't true. I think that people managed to not see the poverty in that era, also because it's the era of the big move out of the cities into the suburbs, and there was a sense of new possibilities. I think that he wrote to a real middle-class group of Americans for whom the city was falling into the background, and for whom Appalachia and some of the rural South, where there were farm workers, the Native American reservations, places like that, were simply invisible to him. So his idea was to help people to see what was invisible, precisely at a time when Americans were beginning to move out of cities and into suburbs where poverty was sort of was hidden away from them.
Now, the term culture of poverty is used by Michael Harrington in the book, but he later abandoned it, didn't use it in some of his later work. Maybe you can talk about how that particular idea has been appropriated by some more conservative commentators.
Harrington borrowed the phrase culture of poverty from Oscar Lewis, who had written about Puerto Ricans, about Mexicans coming to the North. And the big question of his era and subsequently was a comparison, looking at other ethnic groups that had moved into industrial cities in America, and, you know, Poles and Swedes and Irish and Italians and you name the group, who had come and had succeeded. And there was some question looking, because it seemed as if African Americans and Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, the first groups, at least in the North where I live, were not succeeding in the same way. And some sociologists and thinkers asked questions about whether it had to do with the culture that people brought with them and a preparedness for work in the industrial cities, or whether this was something else. Harrington used the phrase culture of poverty to try to signal that being poor wasn't just a status, that it changed the whole person's way of life. I think there is a problem with the way that he victimized people. So he was arguing that this culture of poverty made it endure. So it wasn't something that you just changed quickly. You gave someone a job or a possibility and it would go away. Now, the way that it's been used subsequently in the debates was certainly picked up by the neoconservatives in the 1980s. By the way, Harrington's the guy who coined the phrase neoconservative, as it happened. But it was picked up by the neocons in the 1980s and the Republican era under Reagan, largely, I would say, to blame the people who were poor. And this was the problem. So the argument was a culture that people brought, that something needed to change them from it. There's a debate between so-called people who focus on structure, structuralists, and people who focus on culture. One of the great talks we had was William Julius Wilson, who's focused on this considerably in his work. And Wilson asked the question about African Americans, particularly who moved to the North. So he had this kind of a question about culture. And he said it's not that they brought Southern values with them, rural values, and that they weren't ready to adjust. Wilson was really good at looking at what kinds of structural things were happening in the American economy that made it hard for those groups to succeed. They, in a sense, they immigrated at the wrong time. If you look at a city like I live in, like Worcester, and you went back to the era when the other groups immigrated, there was industry growing. There were many factories open. There were kinds of jobs that were available for people with a modicum of education, perhaps hadn't finished high school, but could find decent factory work where you could raise a family. Harrington, when he wrote about this, seems to have been a bit unaware of these broad structural changes, the jobs that were permanently leaving the North, headed south in the U.S. and then to Mexico and then out of the country entirely. I'm not sure he was clearly aware of it, but what we have to do today is to begin to look at the ways that what we might think of as a structure, as a culture of poverty, arises from structural issues in a permanently changing economy in America. And we can do that much better now, I think, than we could in Harrington's time. A number of people have put a little bit of blame, well, Barbara Ehrenreich, particularly in a recent Nation article, blamed him for using the phrase culture of poverty, and she blamed him for the way that people following him used that. I think that was really unjust on her part to have done that. Harrington clearly didn't use the phrase afterwards. I think he was a little lazy in the way that he borrowed it, but he wanted to give people a holistic picture or a sense that as a way of life that develops, that comes out of this, something big that has to be and can be intervened on.
Now, my understanding of the conference at the Holy Cross was that the first day addressed the legacy and writings of Michael Harrington, and the second looked at some of the issues he might be writing about today, one of which is the issue of incarceration of large number of people, especially African Americans. Maybe you could talk about that.
Sure. What we wanted to do on the second day was to ask, if someone were to try and write a book like The Other America today, what would a person need to write about? And I approached that with a little bit of trepidation because there are so many topics. There are more than we could talk about in a day. We weren't able to do anything on Native Americans, on reservations. There are lots of invisible other Americans, if you will, who are laboring away, who are the working poor in America, who might work in nursing homes and take care of elderly people for minimum wage. So there are lots of invisible America we couldn't do. One of the things that I really did want to concentrate on was one that might seem counterintuitive that you mentioned, and that's about prisons and about mass incarceration in America. And I did that because I think that's probably the most significant structural change since Harrington's time, and it's one that I think is going to have one of the longest-term impacts in terms of perpetuating a permanent underclass across generations in America. If you compared even going up from 1970 to 2003, there are seven times as many prisoners in America. Some 6% of the adult male population in America has been in prison or on probation. Among African Americans, enormous numbers, especially some two-thirds of high school dropouts who are African Americans will end up in the prison system. You know, I've been to prisons before, working with some chaplains who worked there, and visited, spent some time around there, was involved in a Jesuit prison ministry. And, you know, it's become very clear to me that how much our prisons are about punishment and not about hope, that there's not a particular plan for reintegrating people into American society. So we've taken a huge swath of the poor in America. They've come into the criminal justice system, and we know in terms of life chances that those, usually men, who come out of that have remarkably diminished life chances, not only for the things that might have gotten them sent to prison, but thereafter, that employees screen to prevent hiring people of criminal record, their marriage chances are remarkably low, their chances of finding jobs, all of that certainly would be around perpetuating it. If you look at family issues, there are 1 million black children in America who have a father in jail. Obviously, not only black children, but you think of generationally what it's like to have an experience of having a parent who is incarcerated. I think that the effect on family is remarkable. Now, there's no question that the effort to this movement for mass incarceration from the 70s, 1980s especially, has had some positive effect in terms of communities of poor people. They would be the ones who would most likely to have crime against them, violent crime. But the thing you have to remember about this is that one-third of those people who are in jail are there for violent crime. Two-thirds of them are there for continued minor drug charges, for property crimes. And it's a time when I think we have a system that's clearly not working. My hope is that there is actually some political will to begin to address that. You certainly see it in places like California, especially where the prisons are overcrowded, and people who are very concerned about crime start to look at this and say, you know, if you've got a system where the outcome is what it is, you can say this isn't working. We have to think about that. But when I look at it and I say, what is the effect of this incarceration on communities, on creating permanent underclass? You know, if you've been around anywhere and you see kids going around with their pants hanging down to their knees, you know, that's a copy of prisons and the way that prison culture and the things that have gone on there have impacted white and black urban communities in America is really quite remarkable. And I think it's one of the things that Harrington would want to take a look at again today and really be able to address.
You mentioned earlier that Harrington took up the tradition of people like Norman Thomas and Eugene Debs, other socialist leaders, but it seems there's no obvious successor to Harrington in the socialist arena. Is that true? And if so, what kind of problems does that pose for our political culture?
Well, that's something that Mike Kazin and Tom Chagrou talked about in their presentations on Thursday, the first day of the conference. I think that the first thing that it affects is that the term socialism gets bandied about so much now that so many non-socialist liberal politicians are afraid of being tarred with it. The first way that it's clearly affected our culture is that there are no politicians out there who are really adequately ready to talk about poverty. Everyone wants to talk about the middle class, and as soon as we talk about income inequality and about the poor especially, the term socialist comes out, and Obama's called a socialist. I think if Harrington were actually around and we had a real socialist who could sort of laugh and say, no, what Obama's doing is not socialist, it's middle of the road, we could really get an honest conversation about where people stand. But so far it's worked. It's moved the line from what is center. It's moved it further and further towards the right, and it's really disempowered a lot of people who could have spoken more clearly. I don't, you know, socialism has always been a minor political movement in America. A number of people pointed out that if Harrington were alive and he were in a European country, he might well be head of state or he'd be a powerful political figure. So I'm not suggesting that socialism would ever be a really powerful movement in America, but it would actually help us explain what the real spectrum is, whereas now that spectrum has been taken away from us, and people who are thoughtful centrists are dishonestly portrayed as being socialists. So that's what I would hope Harrington would recenter. And I think he'd give us a little bit of sense of passion. What I've heard about is how eloquent a speaker he was, how much he would make people believe that it's possible to address these problems. As I say, I can't find a politician who's doing that adequately today.
We want to thank Tom Landy for speaking with us. And now we feature some remarks from Morris Isserman, the Publius Virgilius Rogers Professor of American History at Hamilton College and Michael Harrington's biographer. You can look to our website for a link to full remarks from Professor Isserman, as well as other commentary from the conference at Holy Cross.
When Michael Harrington's The Other America, Poverty in the United States first appeared in March of 1962, Mike had modest ambitions for it, expecting to sell a few thousand copies. Instead, it proved a publishing phenomenon, garnering substantial sales, wide and respectful critical attention, and a significant influence over the direction of social welfare policy in the U.S. during the decade that followed. By February 64, Business Week noted that The Other America is already regarded as a classic work on poverty, and Time magazine listed it as one of the 10 most influential books of the 20th century, along with Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents and Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. Harrington revealed to his readers that an invisible land of the poor, over 40 million strong, or one in four Americans at the time, fell below the poverty line. For the most part, this other America existed in rural isolation and in crowded slums where middle-class visitors seldom ventured. That the poor are invisible, he wrote, is one of the most important things about them. They are not simply neglected and forgotten, as in the old rhetoric of reform. What is much worse, they are not seen. But what remains vital in the other America, these many years later, is its moral clarity. In the final chapter of the book, Harrington asked his reader to make use of their vision, and to do so in two senses. First, he asked them to, quote, see through the wall of affluence and recognize the true dimensions of poverty in the United States and its cost in human dignity. Second, he declared that his readers needed to deploy their vision, quote, in the sense of purpose and aspiration. Harrington summoned his readers to war on poverty, not just for the sake of the poor, but for their own sakes. Americans, he felt, should be unwilling to live in a society that, having the resources to provide everyone a decent standard of living, was instead increasingly divided into two nations. The fate of the poor, he concluded, hangs upon the decision of the better off. If this anger and shame are not forthcoming, someone can write a book about the other America a generation from now, and it will be the same or worse.